Hello, everybody. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whenever or however you're listening. I hope you're doing well. It is Rubio's State Department. Originally, I was bringing on my guests today to talk about Somalia, and we will still talk about that and some of the other developments. But with the stuff going on in Venezuela, I feel like this was a little bit more apt because it seems to me at this point, and obviously I'm going to get my guest opinion here in a minute, that much like Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken had ran the State Department under Joe Biden, it kind of seems like Rubio's running the State Department under Donald Trump, which is not good. So anyways, before we get to today's show, please make sure you go to all the links below to check out everything my guest got going on, where you can find him, support him, all that good stuff. He just did an appearance on Part of the Problem, and also they're doing a fundraiser. I'll let him speak about that here in a moment, and like I said, all the links below for that. Of course, go to all the links for me below, where you can find myself, everything I've got going on. Of course, the Common Crown has new music coming out. I need to start putting my Substack down there, but go check out the Great Megalodon on Substack to get all your heavy metal news that I'm trying to put out as much as possible. And of course, tigerfitness.com, use the code Kyle at checkout. And without further ado, let's get into the rest of today's show about Rubio's State Department. And welcome back to the show, my dear friend, Dave DeCamp. How you doing, man?
I'm good, Kyle. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. Well, real quick, why don't you let everybody know what you've been up to lately? It seems like you've been quite around the world.
Well, what have I been up to? Well, I did Dave Smith's show yesterday, Part of the Problem, which was cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, just regular work for us at antiwar.com. We're doing our fundraiser now. Which we do every three, depending on how things go, every three or four times a year, we have to do a fundraiser, and we're trying to raise $100,000. What's cool this year is that we got 50 grand in matching funds, which means every dollar you donate gets doubled. Usually we can't, you know, get the full amount in the half that we want in matching funds. So that means we'll hopefully be able to wrap it up quickly. But if people appreciate our work and they can help us out, that is antiwar.com/donate. But yeah, we've just been chugging along, trying to cover all these wars that are going on, and new ones seem to keep popping up on us. So it's been a little difficult.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask was about the Ron Paul Institute event, because I know you were there, and unfortunately, I didn't get to make it this year. I think it was literally, my daughter was like a week old, so I'm like, this kind of sucks. But how was that? It looked like there was an awesome lineup of speakers. I know we talked about it a little bit in the DMs, but why don't you let the audience know about that?
Yeah, it was really cool. The Ron Paul Institute events, the DC conferences, are always great. We hung out at the one last year, but this year was awesome. I spoke at the student seminar that they do it on the Friday before, which is always cool. You get to meet some younger people who are inspired by Ron Paul, and then hung out Friday night, and then the talks were really great during the conference on Saturday. Jeffrey Sachs was there. They did a live Judging Freedom with Colonel McGregor and Max Blumenthal and Anya Parampil. And I really enjoyed their talk, because their talk was about their recent trip to Iran. They were just there like a few weeks before the war, which I always think that's really interesting, just what it's like to go to, you know, a place like Iran and walk around and meet people and talk to people. So that was very cool. Natalie Morris from Redacted was there too. She gave a great speech, and of course Dan McAdams was great. Ron Paul, he piped in virtually, because they did the Ron Paul birthday event the weekend before, so he wasn't up for the trip. I kind of had a feeling that was going to happen, but it was cool to see him talk. Just didn't get to see him in person, but I mean, the events are so great. It's just cool to meet people, and it like recharges your battery. It's good to do stuff in person. One day, someday, I want to put on like an antiwar.com conference, you know, make Scott the headliner somewhere. I think it is really valuable, like the in-person interaction, just getting people into a building, especially these days where just everything is online and, you know, so many people work from home and everything.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I know we had a good time last year. Unfortunately, I think you and a few other people that we were kind of hanging out with got sick on, what was it, Saturday. But overall, it still was a good event. And yeah, I definitely agree with you that it's just really nice to kind of get out and just be around other people, warm bodies in a building, even if it's only for a few hours. And yeah, last year, the talks, sometimes it almost seems like they drag on. But when you're kind of done with it, you're like, yeah, actually, this was a lot of fun. And like, I really enjoyed everything I learned. So, yeah, I definitely can't recommend that stuff enough. And, yeah, doing like an anti-war event specifically for antiwar.com, that would be, I think I'd be very, very well supported. And because you guys have all sorts of people that you could probably pull from, geez, you guys could probably get like Roger Waters or somebody to, speak at it too, you know?
Yeah. 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 That would be pretty cool.
Yeah. First comment. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Impure Hunter. Hopefully I said that right.
Hey, he was there. Oh.
Yeah, yeah, he had mentioned. It's always hilarious that people think that Rubio's reformed or different. He's still the same old neocon. So this kind of gets into today's show. It's just bizarre to me that there's so many people celebrating the bombing of this ship off the coast of, what the hell was it? Like, leaving from Venezuela. And I think you and I might be of the perspective, like, if this was like legitimate drug trafficking, then it's like, yeah, I wouldn't be in favor of the people being killed, but I wouldn't be like firmly, I wouldn't be losing that much sleep over it. But there seems to be no questions asked, and you just see people full on celebrating this. And it's pretty rich coming from the people who claim that Trump destroyed the neocons, but somehow Marco Rubio, chief neocon, bombing Venezuela. And we know this is obviously just another step for regime change. Somehow that's really sticking it to the neocons. I can't square this math. So what the hell happened and what's going on with the ship from Venezuela?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I like the title of this episode, Rubio State Department. Because by all indications, it is Rubio kind of calling the shots here. Yeah. And I do think genuinely Trump does want military action against cartels and drug traffickers. But, you know, a lot of this, you know, what you see in the MAGA right and among Republicans and voters, which I certainly sympathize with, is it's the outrage over the fentanyl and the opioid and heroin deaths, all the overdoses that we see from that. And that stuff does not come from Venezuela. You know, that mainly comes through Mexico, like 99% of it or something. And the allegations that Maduro is like a narco terrorist and that his government's involved in all this drug trafficking is over cocaine. And with cocaine, if you look at the data, like the DEA numbers, the majority, again, comes from Colombia, like 93% or so of the coke that ends up in the U.S., its origin is Colombia. And some of it goes through Venezuela, you know, through the Caribbean to get to the U.S., but it's a very small percentage. The vast majority goes through the Pacific, you know, the stuff that goes through boat goes through the Pacific, or some of it goes through Mexico. So this is not what this is about. Like, they're, you know, if they were trying to take action against drug trafficker, like if that was really the main goal here, I think we would see something different. I think it just, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that it just happens to be the country that the Secretary of State has been dreaming of regime change in for decades is the one that, you know, is where all the fentanyl is coming from. I mean, it's just not true. So I think people need to understand that, because I mean, I'm trying to be charitable with people. Like I understand the sentiment. A lot of people on the right, you know, the cartels are very, you know, bad groups. And a lot of Americans and a lot of people I know have died because of the stuff that is flooding our country. But I think in general, like the idea of turning the drug war into a hot war is misguided. It's not a problem you could bomb away, the fact that so many people in our country use these drugs. Especially fentanyl. I mean, it's so small, like to smuggle it in, there's so many different ways that you could do it. But so I think they are taking advantage of kind of that genuine outrage over the opiate crisis, and using that to push another agenda. 'Cause you see so many people celebrating this, and you know, there's holes in the whole narrative. Like we're just being told a lot of lies. They claim that they targeted Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang. That they claim is controlled by Maduro, but that was contradicted by, you know, U.S. intelligence assessment from a few months ago said that that was not true. And as far as I can tell, like, there's no evidence that Maduro is the leader of this gang. And they also claim he's the leader of the Cartel of the Suns, which is not a real thing. It's a term that's used to describe basically a network of Venezuelan government and military officials, like kind of lower level, who are allegedly involved in drug trafficking. And in like Latin American countries, there's a lot of corruption, and, you know, people let certain things happen when it comes to drug trafficking and the shipment of drugs. And that probably is the case in Venezuela, but the Cartel of the Suns isn't real. It's literally like a term used to describe, because they have like a sun, like the Venezuelan military, like a sun is part of their insignia. And this term actually goes back to before Chavez even took power in the 1990s. So just this idea that it's like a narco terrorist government, you know, that's the line, is just, I mean, it actually goes back to Bill Barr, the first Trump administration. He indicted Maduro, calling him a narco terrorist and claimed that he's involved in all this drug trafficking. And again, if you just look at the numbers of, this is all based on cocaine. If you just look at the cocaine numbers, it's just not like a significant amount that goes through Venezuela, really. Compared to what goes through the you know, other channels. You know, we're being lied to, we're being manipulated here. And there's no reason to believe our government and the military when they claim that they identified these people in this boat. You know, like Trump claims they're all confirmed members of the gang, but I think this was really about setting a precedent. And I think it's a really dangerous precedent, the fact that our government can claim, oh, these people are narco terrorists. That means that we could blow them up. So, you know, there's a lot wrong with what happened here. I mean, even Rand Paul said today, you know, like, you know, if this happened in our country, like, if the boat was off our coast, we wouldn't blow it. Like, there's no situation where we would blow it up. At least I don't think. Maybe now, who knows? But what do? You intercept the boat, you board it, you find the drugs, you arrest the people. And if it's like law enforcement, then you try to get them to tell you where the drugs came from, who's running the operation here. So it's just a really kind of crazy thing that they did here. On the other hand, you have Venezuela. I've seen a couple of Venezuelan officials claim that that it was fake, that the video was AI, that it didn't happen. So at least they're not like reacting in a way that could makes war more likely here with Venezuela. But I think they're going to keep pushing this whole regime change, this push toward regime change. I really do think that that's what this is about, because you don't send an armada of Navy vessels to blow up a little dinghy, you know, so the whole thing is very sketchy.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's amazing that people don't kind of see this, because it really seemed to go under the radar during Trump's first term, the whole Operation Gideon, where they sent a couple of U.S. troops down there and attempted to recognize Juan Guaido as the official president of Venezuela. And then, like, even in the campaign up at the beginning part of last year, I think it was Elon Musk and all these people were talking about putting a bounty back on Maduro's head. And then, of course, now this has been carried through. And it's like, you guys don't recognize this is kind of how this works. Like, this is regime change propaganda in motion here. Like, I don't understand. And one other thing I'm kind of curious your thoughts on is Maduro claiming that he like mobilized the whole, like his whole military along his coast. Can you kind of elaborate on that? And yeah, just kind of how this regime change operation is moving.
Yeah, I know that he says he deployed 15,000 troops to the border of Colombia. He's claimed that he mobilized this like pro-government militia, which they claim has like millions of members. I don't really know how true that is, but there's certainly, you know, there's been some deployments. They say they're increasing naval patrols, which, I mean, I guess there's a potential there for some kind of confrontation at sea. And then what would happen? But, you know, I mean, when it comes to Maduro, like, they're really giving him like a gift here, because his whole narrative is like, you know, the imperialists are out to get me and everything. And that's what the sanctions totally play into that. And this even more so now they're sending all these ships. It's hard to imagine, like, you know, I've seen some officials say, there was one official quoted in Axios saying it could be Noriega part two, referring to the 1989 invasion of Panama that took out Manuel Noriega, but I don't, they haven't sent a force that's like big enough for an invasion. But also another official said, you know, they could potentially launch a drone strike to take out Maduro. And when it comes to U.S. regime changes, I mean, the goal hasn't really been installing a new regime. Like a lot of it is just destabilization, and that could end up happening here. And like doing that in our own hemisphere is really insane. You know, like the sanctions exacerbated, you know, that they imposed in 2019 really exacerbated the economic crisis in Venezuela. And we saw, you know, many more migrants leaving and coming here to the U.S. And according to U.S. law enforcement, like they Tren de Aragua, this Venezuelan gang has been active here in the past couple of years. And that, you know, came after this huge migrant crisis caused by trying to do a regime change there. Imagine how bad it could be if like we just blow like up the presidential palace up or something, like, you know, who knows what that could lead to. So yeah, the whole thing just seems crazy. And so back to that Axios report that I mentioned, that report was saying basically that like the members of the Trump administration don't actually know what is going on here. Like if this is about drug trafficking or a push for regime change. And I actually believe that, like, that a lot of them just don't really know. They're just kind of going with it. And, you know, it also came after they eased some sanctions to allow Chevron to pump oil in Venezuela again. So it's just, and with this Trump, like people try to make sense of this stuff. I think it's just really hard to do, because I think in some cases they're just shooting off the hip. They don't even really know what they're doing.
You know, that really seems to be a summary of the Trump State Department. And obviously, I think Trump plays a part in this, but I do think a lot of it is Rubio. The longer that we've kind of been at this and watched it, just like all the negotiations, it always seems like they come in and they always have like these completely unreasonable expectations with whoever they're trying to negotiate with. And then as soon as they basically get nowhere in negotiations, because they always start with non-starters, then they're like, oh, these people are being completely unreasonable. They won't talk to us, or like negotiations aren't going well, so we're going to impose more sanctions and tariffs. And I'm always kind of sitting back watching, like, none of this ever seemed like it was going to work in the first place. Like, you know, let's go to Iran. Iran was never going to give up nuclear enrichment. Russia was never going to allow peacekeeping troops. Gaza was never going to completely disarm, or at least, you know, the Palestinians were never completely disarm. The Houthis were never going to really back down from a fight. Like all of these negotiations, like I thought Witkoff, and I remember Tucker saying Witkoff is touched by like the hand of God or something like that. But now it just seems like he has no fucking idea what he's doing. And it seems like you're kind of reading the same thing.
Oh yeah. 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 I had a little hope for him at first when, you know, he went over and they say he pressured Netanyahu to agree to that ceasefire deal. Mm-hmm. But since then, I mean, you know, there was the whole thing, Hamas, I forget his name. I want to say Edon Alexander, the American IDF soldier, the kid from New Jersey who joined the IDF and was captured on October 7th. Hamas released him like as a goodwill gesture to the U.S. And apparently Witkoff said that, you know, he would get Israel to allow more aid in, because I think it was during, I forget exactly the timeline, but I think it was when they had they weren't letting anything in. And he just totally went back on everything that he, you know, offered to do in exchange for Hamas releasing him. And I saw him, like, he did an interview after the Trump-Putin summit, I think, or maybe it was before it, right before it, where he claimed that Russia said that, you know, the West could provide NATO-style security guarantees for Ukraine. It's like, there's no way that that's true. And what I figured he was talking about was, like, during the 2022 negotiations that the U.S., like, discouraged, there was some like vague security guarantees that, but like all the permanent members of the UN Security Council would be involved in them, which includes Russia and China. So I figured it was something like that. But then he's going around saying, oh, they agreed to Article 5 NATO style security guarantees. And now that's the thing that Zelensky and all the Europeans are insisting on. And the US is saying they're going to back this. And Russia's saying that's not going to happen. So there's a good chance of, you know, right now it still seems like there's a hope for some kind of Ukraine deal. The way Putin has been talking about it is very positive. Like when he was in China the other day, he's saying that, you know, the Trump administration, you know, he's speaking nicely of Trump, saying that they do genuinely want peace here and that there's a lot of light at the end of the tunnel, that there's hope for a deal. But then just today they had like the big meeting of all the Europeans and Zelensky, and they're saying they're going to send troops. And it's like, like what world are they living in? And Trump is saying, you know, he said publicly, he's like, oh yeah, you know, we could send planes, you know, we'll help him out. It'll be the Europeans on the ground. But yeah, it's just not going to happen. I mean, unless this is a negotiation tactic that they're trying to like, you know, get some leverage on Russia before going further. But I don't know. It's just hard to believe that this is going to go anywhere. And then the whole narrative now is like, oh, the NATO countries are, Europe's paying for it. We're not going to pay for it. You know, so they seem perfectly happy to let the war go on as long as they're not spending as much as Biden did, I guess.
Yeah, which is a very bizarre thing to me, because it's like we pay for a decent bit of NATO and we're telling Europe to up their spending on NATO. And literally all it's going to do is basically allow Europe to buy more weapons off the US, which are going to get funneled in Ukraine. And it's like, we don't have the leverage to give Ukraine. Like, essentially, you just have to take what you're going to get from Russia, because, you know, from Putin's perspective, he's winning. So why would he stop? And that it doesn't seem to like factor into Trump's mind. Like, you don't have the cards. I know he told Zelensky he doesn't have the cards, but he doesn't realize he doesn't have the cards either. So, you know, and like, what are you going to do? Are you going to give Ukraine more weapons? I mean, he has given Ukraine more weapons, but like, are you just going to give him more? Like, we're 3 years into this thing.
Yeah, more sanctions going on.
Yeah, we're almost 4 years in, and you're just going to try to do more of the same and hope that you get a different outcome. I don't see it. So I'm not putting two and two together here. I think Trump had a golden opportunity when he first came in, but then he just chose not to do it. And I could believe that was Rubio that was partially behind that one too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, like with Rubio really calling the shots on a lot of things, apparently he's the one in charge of the security guarantee negotiations, which like, that's not a good sign. No. A lot of people wanted to believe that he went through some kind of transformation and that he's like a realist now, but I don't think that's the case at all. But yeah, the stuff with Russia, there was something else I was going to say. I'm blanking on it though, with the Europeans and Trump. I forget, but it's just, you know, like it seems like it's just going to go on. I mean, they're still like, there hasn't been the moment where they're like, okay, peace talks are off. The war is on. Let's go. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see something like that soon.
Mm. Yeah, I wanted to be hopeful, but with the way Trump was campaigning and the way that he spoke about the war in Ukraine, I was like, yeah, I don't see him bringing this to an end. And no one ever pressed him on it. I remember
he never actually talked about it. He'd just say, oh, never would happen. I could end it in a day. But nobody said, okay, how are you going to do that?
Well, I remember one interview, and I wish for the life of me I could find it. I tried to use AI to find it, but I can still see it, and I could still hear it, where someone pressed him on it, and he finally gave an answer. He said, well, I'll tell Russia that you better watch what you're doing, because I'll give Ukraine more than they've ever gotten, and I'll tell Ukraine. He basically offered the strategic ambiguity position. So basically what we give to Taiwan, he wanted to do with Ukraine. But in my mind, I'm like, that's not going to work. Like, everybody knows that wouldn't work.
Yeah. No, I remember in one interview, he did say, like, oh, I'll tell Putin, you know, if you don't stop, I'm going to give Ukraine everything, and, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, unfortunately it seems like it's just going to go, and the Europeans are just all crazy and like ready to go to war with Russia. Like the way they talk is just, except with the few exceptions, the way all the European leaders talk about Russia and Ukraine and the future is just like unhinged. They're talking about like getting ready for war with Russia. Russia is going to invade in a few years. Like, we have to be ready. And the whole thing is now like we're saying, okay, you know, the Trump administration is saying Europe's got to take the lead. They have to pay. You know, this is your thing now. It's like you're handing this to these people. Like, that's not good.
Yeah. Well, and like the whole goal was to end the war, but if you're trying to end the war, then why would you, like you said, pass it off to the people who seem to want to do nothing but escalate it? Screwed up Nevsky. Yeah, this is actually a good point. At least Trump is talking to and meeting with Putin and not just bending the knee to Zelensky, though. Way better than Biden and Kamala, which isn't saying much, but still better. The only pushback I would give here, and Dave, I'm curious your thoughts as well, is that Trump essentially has bent the knee for Zelensky. I know Zelensky made a big deal about it, but like, you know, there was that whole, oh, he dressed Zelensky down and oh, it's genuine. But then what ultimately happened? He got the minerals deal and like they backed off on like some of the security yeah. guarantees that they were initially talking about. But now we're literally more involved in Ukraine than we've been under Biden. All the sanctions are still there. Trump sent more weapons there using the same exact policy that Biden did. So he bent the knee to Zelensky because Zelensky still got everything he wanted.
Yeah. When it comes to the point about the fact that he's talking to Russia, I think that that is a fair point, that it is much better
yes,
that they're talking. Yeah. And I think, you know, again, what we see from Putin and just the Kremlin in general, when they're asked about the U.S., like they're very, you know, like it's just a different attitude that they have, you know, because when you had Biden, it was like scary. I mean, the fact that you have this proxy war going on and there's no high level communication at all between the U.S. and Russia. I mean, like, how was the Cuban Missile Crisis diffused? Like, the leaders of the Soviet Union and the U.S. got on the phone and talked it out. Mm-hmm. So the fact that that is a part that, like, it is good that, let's say, a Russian missile, like, you know, they accidentally fire a missile or a drone hits, like, a NATO base or something. Like, now we know Trump would probably get on the phone with Putin, like, right away. You know, we didn't know that would happen with Biden. Like the nukes could just start flying. So I think that is better. But when it comes to Zelensky, I mean, that's kind of the shame of it. Sorry. There's like a huge thunderstorm starting outside. And
okay. Yeah. I was going to say you could go deal with something if you needed.
No. Just a lot of times I might lose power, but what was I saying? Trump would get on the phone, but the shame of it is that like that Oval Office meeting mm-hmm. when they had it out with Zelensky. I mean, that was the opportunity right there to end it.
Yes.
To say, you know, it was like served up to Trump on a platter. Zelensky came into town and he was being completely disrespectful. His whole base would have supported him just saying, that's it, you're off. You got to make a deal right now. You got to have elections and and Zelensky would have been out. But that didn't happen. You know, he paused the weapons, so they say, but then they spoke, you know, U.S. and Ukrainian officials had like a meeting a week later, and then all the intelligence and weapons continued to flow again. And what was that? I think that was like in February, right? Like at the end of February. Yeah. You know, that was it. I was really excited that day because I thought that was it. Like I thought Trump was going to say, all right, you know, you're done. You're cut off. Like I said, the perfect opportunity. And now we see them, we're not paying for it anymore, but yeah, you're still paying for the shipments that Biden approved and you're still providing intelligence that costs money. You still have all these troops deployed in Europe. They're not drawing any of the troops down that Biden sent over there. Trump just met with Poland's new president and, you know, he was asked by a journalist, are you going to keep the troops there? Because there's been some talk about them potentially reducing troops in Europe. And he said, oh yeah. I'll send more if he wants, you know, like, so there still is a lot of cost to this. You know, we're not seeing a change in the U.S.-NATO relationship beyond the fact that they're saying, you know, NATO's got to pay more. You guys got to increase your military spending. Like, that's not going to fix things. That's just going to raise tensions and keep things kind of heated up.
Yeah, it really seems like, and once I started thinking about it this way, I couldn't unsee it. It really seems like what they want to do is basically hand off Russia, the Russian situation to the EU and say like, here, you guys take care of Russia. They want to hand Israel off to Iran or, you know, however that works out. Basically, we're going to let you guys fight it out. And then we want to fight a war with China, but also with, you know, the help of Australia, South Korea, and India, but now that doesn't seem like it's gonna work. So I can't help but see it that way, because, you know, okay, so if we're raising up NATO spending, then that to me seems like the logical next step. Like, hey, we're gonna get you to raise your defense spending so you can buy more weapons from us, and so that way you can defend your backyard, which I get, but we're also implicated in that.
Yeah. But I mean, that also has to involve like at least a troop drawdown, like bring troops home from Europe, close some of these bases, like the one in Romania. Mm-hmm. Like these are, you know, in kind of the more provocative locations, and, you know, we're not seeing that. But, you know, like the India thing, you know, you mentioned it. It's crazy that they're just like tanking the U.S. relationship with India over them buying oil from Russia.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, there's some trade war element to it. And apparently India is now saying they're going to get rid of tariffs on U.S. goods or something. So maybe that'll improve the relations. But I mean, Modi, if just at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit this week, you know, was praising Putin, saying, you know, we're going to increase our trade relationship and in every possible way. And like, you know, like, I mean, this.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
The idea that Trump, you know, I think he might have learned his lesson. Like, you know, he put these tariffs on India, telling them to stop buying Russian oil. I think he might have realized that that wasn't really a viable option, because if you remember, he had this like deadline that he set that he was going to put these, you know, secondary sanctions and secondary tariffs on Russia's trading partners. And really that meant putting huge tariffs on Russia and India. And he did put some on India, but then he kind of backed down. He didn't do anything with China.
Right.
And then he started this new push toward negotiations, setting up the summit with Putin. So I think he might have realized, or whoever's calling the shots was like, all right, we're not going to be able to sanction our tariff our way out of this. It's going to make things worse for us. So maybe we'll try a new like diplomatic path here. But who knows what might happen if this thing totally falls apart. The other possibility is just things kind of remaining cordial between Trump and Putin, and things just going on as they are until a Democrat comes in, and who knows what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think that's probably going to be the situation where it's Trump and Putin have a good relationship. I feel like Putin would have been welcoming to Biden if Biden would have reached out to him, but I think his own State Department was like working so far against him that there was just no way for him to extend a handout. But to me, and I'm curious your thoughts on this as well, is like, it just seems like Trump thinks we're still living in like the 2010 to like 2015-ish world. But the fact is that like Russia and China are much more powerful than they were 10 years ago when Trump first took office. And it doesn't seem like Trump's like grappling with that. Like Putin and Xi and even Modi just are like, yeah, like if we could do business with the US, that's cool. But if not, like it's no big deal. We have our own countries and territories that we could trade with. The Shanghai Cooperation, BRICS, all of these other organizations that were just like, yeah, you know what? We could do business elsewhere. Like we don't need the US anymore. And it doesn't seem like that really has sunken in for the Trump, you know, establishment essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And at the same time, I mean, China, the way they've been kind of dealing with Trump has been like relatively like respectful. Yes. And even the same thing with Trump, like he hasn't really, you know, like he seems to be respecting China at least. You know, they're engaging in this trade war, obviously, but it's not like, you know, China's still playing ball with the U.S. to an extent, but also more like kind of speaking out against the U.S. sanctions and bullying, as she calls it, and like having these, you know, like, I mean, I do think like the Chinese military parade that we just saw, that was like, you know, she really put on display like the option for a different, you know, player, you know, world order than the U.S. led one, you know, hosting all these leaders and having this huge military parade. But, you know, the fact is that China and the U.S. are still very intertwined with each other. Mm-hmm. And they can't just kind of pull the plug. Either side can't just like pull the plug. So they're still playing ball to an extent. But at the same time, you still have the U.S. military doing very provocative things near China, deploying these new missile systems and building new bases and building these alliances. Although that's taken a hit because of India was like a big player in that. And they're, you know, India is seems to be at least like easing tensions with China a bit.
Yeah, India is an interesting situation because they are a founding member of BRICS, and it seemed like they were kind of tiptoeing their way around trying to be friendly with the U.S. and friendly with China. But it like you said, it is funny to kind of watch them basically almost blow up this whole deal over them buying Russian oil and then saying that like Xi and Putin are conspiring against the U.S. Oh, and Kim Jong-un, of course. When it's just like, I think they're like, yeah, once again, we want to do business with the U.S., but it's no big deal if they don't. And like, we wish they would quit fucking with us, but it's ultimately just kind of like a pest. It's not like something we have to really take seriously. And much to your point, when it came to the whole trade war deal, you constantly hear Trump kind of Putin or punting the tariffs off for another period of time. And it just seems like China's like, all right, we'll do this too. Like, if you want to punt the tariffs, we'll punt the tariffs. If you want to have tariffs, we'll have tariffs. Like, we don't really care that much. But there's still, my understanding is, and from everybody I've talked to that lives in China and knows China much better than I do, they always maintain respect for the West, but they don't, you know, they're also not going to get bullied by the West either.
Yeah. And I think like they're probably undergoing a lot of development to become less reliant on certain things from the U.S., you know, and that is part of building up their relationship with Russia and India and everything. But I mean, with India, you know, because India was hesitant to join like the Quad. That's why it didn't really take off until like it never really took off. But it was after it was what was it in 2020 in the summer when Indian and Chinese troops like had a fight on the border in the Himalayas. I forget the exact the name of the area. But they're deployed there like without guns, but they were like fighting with clubs and like I think 20 Indian troops died. And after that, they were like ready to join the Quad in like military exercises. And we started to see that really ramp up. And the U.S. kind of signed these new deal military deals with India, started sharing intelligence with them to kind of surveil Chinese troops on the border there. And that's probably still happening, you know, some of that cooperation. But it seems like the Quad, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I haven't been following this region of the world as much as I used to with everything else going on, but I haven't seen like the big military drills with like the US, Japan, Australia, India, as much as we did a few years ago.
Yeah. And it seemed like India was like a key player too, because the Trump government is just completely stacked with China hawks. Elbridge Colby, Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, JD Vance, all these people are like just nuts about China. And it seems like if you take India off that, then like you really lost a big potential ally in this, you know, coming war with China. But they still got, you know, Taiwan to a degree, Australia, South Korea, and I know I'm missing one, but you know, the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And they're still trying to like inflame tensions there, but it's like not that. It doesn't seem to be like they're going to have the same luck if they can't get India in. There was one. Somalia. I really wanted to talk about Somalia because you've been covering this a lot. And I try to retweet it every single time I see it because, as you stated on your own show, you're one of the only people really talking about this. So what's going on with Somalia, particularly since Trump took office again?
Yeah. So when Trump came in, he ran like dramatically ramped up airstrikes in Somalia. It wasn't necessarily right away that things really ramped up, but one thing he did was he basically loosened the rules of engagement and the restrictions on airstrikes and counterterrorism raids outside of Iraq and Syria. So Iraq and Syria are the only two countries that are considered by the U.S. military like combat zones. So basically what he allowed is lower level military officers to call in airstrikes. And we have seen really starting in like, I mean, it started in February, but it was really like the spring when things like really ramped up. The U.S. really increasing the airstrikes in Somalia against Al-Shabaab in the south, where the U.S. is backing a very weak government that's based in Mogadishu. And then in the northeast, the Puntland region, which is kind of an autonomous region, the U.S. is backing local security forces there against a small ISIS affiliate. And they're basically fighting in like the mountains and in caves and things. But the U.S. has been giving them pretty significant air support. So the number is, it's just a huge number of airstrikes that the U.S. has launched in Somalia. So far, at least 71. It's probably higher at this point, but that's what we know about airstrikes in Somalia in 2025. And Trump broke his own record. The previous record for annual airstrikes was 63, which he set in 2019. And he did the same thing in his first administration. He came into office and kind of lifted restrictions on drone strikes and stuff and ramped up airstrikes in Somalia, but he's taken it to another level. And, you know, I say Trump, but it's really, I don't think it's him directing any of this. I think he just signed and authorized whatever he had to, was convinced by whoever needed to convince him to escalate here. Like I would bet if I was able to ask him about it, he wouldn't be aware that he broke the record for most U.S. airstrikes in Somalia in a single year. Mm-hmm. But I am like literally the only person, like when it comes to like day-to-day, it's not even day-to-day, but covering like each airstrike or each time the U.S. announces an airstrike in Somalia. When it comes to like writing articles, I know there's like just so many YouTubers and stuff. It's hard to know that I'm the only one, but and people have picked up on it, like, from my coverage of it, but it's like in American media, like mainstream media, there's no coverage of this. Once in a while in some of the military focused outlets like Stars and Stripes, you'll see a story like an update like, oh, they've launched a lot of airstrikes in Somalia, but I haven't seen one of those in a while. And like when Trump first launched the big airstrikes against ISIS in Somalia in February, you know, that got coverage because he put out like a video of it. I think there was another time he put out a video of an airstrike, which is like his thing, which I think there's something really kind of sick about that. But it's just it gets no attention. I would really like to conduct a poll of Americans to see how many are aware of this. And then you would have to account for the error that people who aren't aware, there's going to be some who pretend like they know about it. But I would bet if they like polled America, it would be like 95% were not aware of these airstrikes in Somalia. It's just like, it's totally crazy that we can be engaged in a war like this and just nobody is aware. Nobody cares. And I mean, like there's no oversight. So who knows? We don't know what's really happening on the ground. It's all just kind of just goes on without anybody being aware of it.
Yeah. I remember during Scott's debate with the great Scott Horton, when he debated Bill Kristol, at one point, he made sure to kind of highlight the point that this is America's longest war. And I know, I think you made this point on Part of the Problem when you were on yesterday, that, yeah, it is America's longest war because the bombing campaign started in, what was it, 2001, was it? I don't remember the exact year, but, yeah.
Well, when it comes to actual U.S. airstrikes, in 2001, you know, after 9/11 was when they started supporting like these warlords against these people who they claimed were linked to Al-Qaeda or whatever. And then there's evidence that there was probably some airstrikes. I should probably know exactly when like the airstrikes started, but I know after 2006, after Ethiopia invaded, there's evidence of the U.S. giving them air support. And then basically since then, and especially since Obama, there's been drone strikes, but never at anything close to this level that we're seeing now, except for during the first Trump administration. But still, this is, he's taking it to another level here.
Yeah, it's sad. And especially the guy who, you know, pats himself on the back for being the peace president, just absolutely awful. So one other thing I wanted to talk about, is there anything else you want to say on Somalia?
I mean, again, it's like, just, it's really hard to know what's happening on the ground. I mean, one reason why I'm trying to like bring attention to it is to just hopefully other, maybe some journalists with some real resources could try to figure it out more, you know, people kind of with inside sources and stuff. But yeah, it's just, you know, cause we're, most of my work is based on what AFRICOM tells me and what I can find in Somali media, which is not very robust. So it's just really tough. And some of it's very pro-government and just basically propaganda from the US backed government. So we just don't really know what's happening on the ground, but I would bet there's some civilian casualties.
Yeah, I know under a survey was done with Obama's drone strikes, and it was like 96% plus of the casualties were just civilian targets. And then when you take into account Trump's kind of loosening of the guidelines around drone strikes. It's just without a doubt, there have been thousands of civilians killed under, you know, the first and now second Trump administration with all the drone strikes they performed from your peace president. It's worth a told.
Yeah. And they bombed a boat in Somalia a few months ago. Maybe that was like the warm up, like that they claimed was smuggling weapons. And it's like, how do they possibly know that this boat off the coast of Somalia, like, you know, it's probably just based on something the government told them and they said, okay, like, how do you know who's on that boat? Like, it's just, you know, it's just an example of like, you know, there's just no oversight. So they're not going to be careful. They're not going to have to answer for anything because nobody is aware of it or covering it.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing I wanted to talk about, because I've been thinking about this quite a bit, is the 12-day war and how everybody said, oh, Trump's not going to bomb Iran, and then he bombed Iran, and now, oh, we're supposed to believe that. What I keep being told, and I know we've talked about this in private, is that this took away Israel's casus belli, and now they don't have a reason to go to war with Iran, but it seems to me like this issue is still just completely unsettled, and basically all we did is now say that we're willing to go to, you know, at least airstrikes with Iran, which to me, if you ask me, that's kind of like declaring war on a country when you bomb them. Yeah. What's your opinion on the 12-day war and where we're at today?
Well, a big thing that just happened was the snapback sanctions. France, the UK, and Germany, you know, started the process to trigger these UN Security Council sanctions that were lifted as part of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. And, you know, they're really putting Iran in a corner here because they're making all these demands of them. Basically, they want them to restart negotiations with the U.S. And Iran's position has been that they need assurances. They're not going to get bombed again. And you have Israeli officials and Trump, although it's been a little while since he said this. But Trump has said if they restart uranium enrichment, he's going to bomb them again. So that's like the opposite of being assured that you're not going to be attacked. And also domestically inside Iran, nobody wants negotiations with the U.S. right now. Like, nobody trusts the U.S. And that's among the government and the people who had to face that bombing campaign. So, you know, it's a recipe for another war because these sanctions, you know, Iran is saying that there's going to be consequences for the sanctions. Like, they have to do something in response. And one possibility that what the parliament wants is for them to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty, which would probably be used as a pretext for Israel and the U.S. to launch another war. Even though there's a story today on antiwar.com that there's construction at Israel's secret nuclear weapons site where we know there's a nuclear weapons program that's not under any safeguards. They're not a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty. They have nuclear weapons. But besides that, you know, despite that, if Iran withdraws from the NPT, that could be a pretext to launch another war. And the thing that worries me is that Trita Parsi, who's an Iran expert who works for the Quincy Institute, he's basically saying war is inevitable at this point. And he's not someone who's like an alarmist or anything like that. But he's just seeing there's just no possibility for like a deal here with what the other different sides are saying, and like the U.S. still insisting on zero enrichment, and it's clear, you know, Israel didn't achieve its goals in the war. That's another one of his big points, which, you know, this was certainly not a victory for Israel. I mean, and you could see that by the fact that Iran was hitting them with missiles up until the very end, up until the moment of the ceasefire. So this idea that it was a victory, and this idea that they took out the potential pretext for war by bombing the nuclear facilities just isn't true, because it was a phony pretext. The whole thing was fake. There was no evidence that they were making a bomb. Even U.S. intelligence said that, and the IAEA didn't have any evidence. But, you know, it was politicized. There's all this political games going on to give Israel the pretext. But, you know, they're always going to find a way. Netanyahu wants the U.S. to really enter the war more so than just bombing the nuclear facilities. I don't see any situation where the U.S. invades or puts troops in Iran, but I could see the U.S. being involved in a heavy bombing campaign with the goal of basically taking out the government and then just letting the country fall into chaos. I think that's what Israel wants. And that's one good point that Trita Parsi made, What Israel wants of Iran is they want it to be a country like Syria or Lebanon, where that they could just bomb with impunity and not have to worry about them firing back. Because right now, Iran could still fight back and hit them pretty hard. I mean, Israel's never been hit the way that they were hit during that war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that there were a lot of talks, and I think it was Reuters was sharing stories about Israel having like trouble rearming and the U.S. having trouble rearming them. Because obviously, you know, we're sending weapons to Ukraine, but also, like you said, Israel never got hit that hard before. So they had to do a lot to kind of re-up their stock and, you know, also, you know, provide for the Iron Dome and everything. So, yeah, it's not good, man. I think our mutual friend Reed Coverdale made a joke about when he voted for Trump. He's like, what Trump's campaigning on is all this, but we're probably going to get, and he put all this stuff underneath it. One of them was war with Iran. And when he first got in, it was like, oh, there's all these talks. And then when the drone strikes went off, everybody was kind of like, oh, fuck. Yeah. So Impure Hunter said, do you think the Hawks are hoping Iran goes away of Libya? Yeah, I think they're too big of a state to be as failed as Libya, but I wouldn't be shocked if that was a goal. That kind of seemed to be what you were laying out there.
Yeah, no, I think that's what Israel wants. They want to just shatter Iran. It's not about regime change and putting in a friendly government or anything like that, because it's just not realistic. But yeah, they would be happy if it turned into a Libya style situation. Yeah, I think that's what literally what Israel wants.
Yeah. One thing that I made a point of, and I'm surprised more people haven't made this point, is that the Trump administration has now killed people from Venezuela and bombed Iran, both based on lies. Now, for years, people rightfully called out the George Bush administration for lying us into war. Knowingly, and Trump was one of the ones who really led that charge back in 2016 when he was saying how told Jeb Bush that his brother lied us into war. It seems like we're getting the same thing from the Trump administration now, where we're essentially getting lied into a potential regime change war with Venezuela and a potential, you know, drone bombing campaign with Iran, both based on just complete lies.
Yeah, well, and the difference is that they didn't really try that hard, like the propaganda. And same thing with Yemen. That was a total lie. Their justification for that was to protect American shipping. You know, the real reason was to try to get them to not attack Israel, and they failed at that. But yeah, like with Iran, I mean, it was just so clear that the whole narrative was just fake. But, you know, like they had Tulsi Gabbard just a few months before saying that there's no evidence Iran decided to make a nuclear weapon. So all these journalists started asking Trump about that, and he said, oh, I don't know what she said. Forget about what she said. And then Tulsi Gabbard comes out and puts out this statement that doesn't make any sense. She's like, oh, the fake news media is saying I didn't say Iran is making a nuclear weapon. Here's my full statement. And it's literally a statement of her saying there's no evidence Iran is making a nuclear weapon. And like, it was just like the way that this current administration operates, they're just like so full of it. Like, it's just like lie on top of lie, like, and they'll say something to your face that just is the opposite of what's actually happening. And like, it's just more like brazen than, you know, I remember before, like with Biden, the Blinken team. I mean, they're lying the whole time, but at least they had their like narrative about the rules based order. And, you know, obviously that all fell apart once the stuff in Gaza started. But with like Hegseth, I saw on Fox News, he's like, oh, you know, this is, you know, this is the new Trump doctrine. You know, we use precise military action to get things done. Like we had success against the Houthis. And it's like, you did not have success. That was a complete failure. You just killed a whole bunch of people and it achieved nothing. And he says, and Iran. And again, what did that really achieve? And now he's saying with this, taking out this boat, it's like, okay, where's this going to go? You deployed 8 warships to blow up a dinghy. Like something you could have done if you just like flew a drone down there, like, you know, from Puerto Rico or something. It's just like they're just, I don't know, they're just so full of it. And it's very frustrating because to see people eat it up. And a lot of people do eat it up and are ready to just kind of accept it and say, you know, this is what I voted for, bombing the cartels. It's like, well, they're not, you know, they're not even really doing that. Like,
right. Yeah, I don't know how as I said earlier, I don't know how people are seeing this as anything other than just kind of a step towards regime change. And I think we kind of talked about it a little bit earlier, but like, there's just a million different ways you could have dealt with that ship. Even if it did have drugs, like you said, board the ship, blockade it. You have all these warships down there, just stop them. Like, just killing people in cold blood. Like, I thought we're kind of supposed to be against that, but I mean, that's what Israelis do. I know we back them, but like, this is in our own hemisphere. Like, how would feel if they were doing that to us?
Like, kind of the parallel, because we see Israel do this. They say, oh, this journalist's a terrorist, so we killed him. And it's right. Like, okay, so you just can declare that a journalist is a terrorist and kill him. And now it's like, oh, these are narco terrorists, so we just blew them up and killed them. It's like, it's getting closer to home. You know, like, I mean, obviously the U.S. has done this with the drone wars, declaring, you know, putting people on kill lists, not giving them a trial. It's summary execution. But now we're seeing it in our hemisphere, you know, in the Americas. It's scary because, like, you know, could it one day happen here, like at home? Like, you know, it's just, especially with all the surveillance stuff and Palantir and, like, you know, it's just not going in a good direction. And, you know, they're setting this precedent, and who's going to, you know, the next U.S. administration, there's a good chance it could be a Democrat, although I have no idea who they're going to run. But you're going to kind of give all this new power to the Democrats. So I think right-wing people, Republicans, should be keep that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I've been beating the drum since Trump's campaign that they're going to ramp up censorship specifically based around Israel. And now we're kind of seeing it. And people are saying, oh, well, they're just using that to deport people. Well, no, because they floated out that whole, oh, well, you have to sign a pledge to not criticize Israel in order to receive hurricane aid. And they said they pulled it, which they did pull the specific text from it, but they could still do that if they really wanted to. So
yeah,
basically,
I don't think they actually got rid of the policy. Yeah.
No, they never did, which is just absolute insanity to me. Like, I would be somewhat sympathetic if you said, like, hey, you can't criticize America and receive hurricane aid. Wouldn't agree with it, but I'd be like, I guess I get it. But like, the fact that it's Israel of all fucking places, like, or I know they're our greatest ally, but like, a foreign country, like, if we did that for any other country, people would be like, what the fuck is wrong with you? But
yeah,
we always make an exception for this one.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, man.
But
yeah, good.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say with the, you know, and that's kind of the same narrative that we see with the deportations. They're like, oh, they're terrorist supporters because they're basically because they're Palestinian or they're pro-Palestinian or they're critical of what Israel's doing. And then it's just like, that's it. That's the end of the conversation. You could do whatever you want to them. And we're just seeing that, you know, just kind of more and more. And really this whole bombing the boat, like they're merging the war on drugs and the war on terror as if, that's the thing that's really frustrating, like to hear all these people say, oh yeah, we should, you know, bomb the cartels, drone strike them, as if there's been like success, as if the U.S. has had success doing that. Like, there's no model for success here.
Well, yeah. And like, my question with that, when people start arguing with me about this, it's like, well, okay, so if the drone strikes 96% of the time kill civilians by their own data, we're going to say we're going to start bombing the border of Texas to kill the cartels. And now obviously like the ocean, you really don't think that this isn't going to kill Americans? Like, I don't see it any other way. I don't know how they're not going to kill Americans with these kind of drone strikes if you're going to start doing it on cartels, because they're so inaccurate and they have such a high kill rate of civilians. So like, how is this not going to kill average Americans?
Well, if they, I mean, I don't think they're planning to do them in America, because that would be, I mean, you never know.
Well, yeah.
You never know how things are going to go. But yeah, especially, you know, with the drone strikes with cartels, like if, you know, they try to target fentanyl labs that are like among civilian, you know, if there's in an apartment or a trailer, you know, certainly going to be a high chance of civilian casualties there. But, you know, Mexico seems to be very willing to cooperate with the U.S. when it comes to the drug stuff, so hopefully that's kind of like placating them for now. But there is like, there's been reporting saying that they're getting ready to you know, that they are willing to do drone strikes against cartels even if the Mexican government is against it. And I mean, what would, like, what could that turn into? So the whole thing is just crazy.
Yeah, a war on our southern border if people think immigration from Mexico was bad before, if you start drone striking people right on the border of Mexico or in Mexico, you can't expect those people to just lay there and take it. Like, they're going to leave and they're probably going to try to come to the U.S. Now, I don't think they should be let in, but you can't just bomb civilians in their homes and just be like, well, tough shit. You're in with cartels. Like, that's just not how that works. It's not going to work.
Yeah. Yeah. And who knows what the cartels could do, you know, in response. But they'll probably just find a way, you know, maybe it could impact the supply like at first, but people will adapt. There's a lot of money to be made here and fentanyl will still find its way in the country, I would guess.
Yeah, I would think so as well. So we're hitting up on about an hour now, Dave. I always enjoy talking to you. And of course, every single time I ever have a question about anything, you're one of the first people I like to go to because I know you always got your finger on the pulse and you always are writing just an insane amount of articles every single day. So, and of course, I always try to listen to your podcast every single morning to just make sure I'm kind of kept up with all the latest news. So why don't you tell everybody where they could find all that stuff, keep up with your work, and of course, donate to antiwar.com and all you guys.
Yeah, yeah. So all my writing is at antiwar.com, mostly in the news section. You could follow me on X at @TheCampDave. My show is called Anti-War News with Dave DeCamp, but you could just search Anti-War News wherever you listen to podcasts, or you can watch on YouTube or Rumble. And help us out if you can at antiwar.com/donate for our fundraiser. We appreciate everyone that does. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Cool. Well, Dave, as always, it's a pleasure. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in and listening. And until next time, everybody take care and have a good one.